Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Iron Age Marketing. I am Nikki P. here, as always, with my good friend Daniel P. Riley. How are we doing today, Daniel?
I'm doing well. Recovering from illness, so if I have a hacking fit, I apologize.
They'll never see it because I'll edit that thing out.
You'll just see, and then the screen will flick.
We were just talking about how Daniel is my first return guest on the show. So he's feeling pretty special. I say that so he does feel special. We all like to feel a little special every now and again. So the reason we're doing that is because Daniel works in a couple different capacities within the Iron Age space, in the writing sphere. Last time we had him on, we kind of picked his brain from his position as an editor and a facilitator, helping people get their own works of fiction created. But prior to doing that, Daniel's actually been a very busy author himself. I've recently started one of his books. It's going very well. I'm excited to read some more. But we're going to approach the same kind of conversation we had last time, but from the position of a guy who's actually writing books, as opposed to the guy who edits books. And I think the answers are going to be a little bit different this time around. So without further ado, let's kind of get into things. As a guest, give us like the quick recap on, you know, who you are, where you come from, what you do, that whole thing.
Okay. I'm Daniel P. Riley, the owner of whimsyland.org, literary coaching and services, and I am a self-published indie author. I've written, 7 published books, and even though I can't disclose what they are, I've also ghostwritten 3.
Nice. This is big money, right? Writing for other people?
Yeah, unfortunately, it seems to be how it works.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about the work that you've done? Like, that's a number of books. What's your area of expertise when it comes to writing? Are you a science fiction guy, fantasy guy, horror guy? What's your meat and potatoes?
I am a science fiction and fantasy guy. Yeah, I do like horror, and I am working on a horror adjacent book currently. I say horror adjacent because the theme is horror born, but my take on it is a bit more adventure than your traditional scare factor stuff. But yeah, sci-fi and fantasy has been my genre since I was, 8 years old. My uncle used to give me old pulp books that he finished with and really inspired my love of reading, which also inspired my desire to write.
Okay. Now, your journey to being an author, we got into a little bit in the last show, but just in case people are coming at things new, how did that, your uncle's giving you pulp books, and then the next day you're 15 years old, you say, I'm going to become an author, and it's just, that's the trajectory from there.
No. That was my hope, but no, it didn't work out that way. I actually didn't start writing and publishing until, 42. I am 45, so it's been 3 years. But all my life I wanted to. I just kept hearing excuses not to and listening to them. And until pre-COVID, that's when I really got into the desire to follow that dream finally. That's what I did during the COVID lockdowns, was learn how to write.
Okay. And I'm curious, because I know how it affected me. You're a parent. I know that there's a lot of things in my life that I felt pushed to do when I had a kid, because you don't want your kid to like not pursue their dreams. And who are you to tell them to do it if you're not doing the things that you want to be doing in life? Is that part of your story as well?
Very much so. Being a single parent, very different. You have to wear a ton of hats, and I put aside everything in order to facilitate the best life for my daughter, which was, I had to go to school for my degree, for the career that I had chosen, which was the safest route that I could take in order to give her the best life I could on a solo person salary. And that meant setting aside things that I wanted to do. But as she got older and I saw the type of person she was becoming and the things that she wanted to do, the same questions were coming up, you know, for her that I had never answered because I put it all aside to pay for her. And that was a good motivation for wanting to finally knuckle down and do this, especially with the backing of the business, which we talked about before, reaching a point where I could sustain us on what I was making from Whimsyland was a big factor in a lot of the changes that I've made over the last year or two, actually 2 years. Yeah. And since then, she's taken to it. She's helping me with the business, and she's learning how to start to independently fund herself with her own skills and aspirations, which, you know, there's nothing that can make me more proud as a parent.
Well, it's a big deal. Like, I know when I was let go from my last job, I made it a point that I was never, ever going to work for somebody again. And, you know, it's not been maybe the easiest year, we'll just say, but, you know, cobbling together my income has been, I feel better as a person than I've ever felt prior to that. You know, it's like, yeah, things are tight sometimes, but everything that's coming in, it's all me. I'm not relying necessarily on somebody to go out and make money for me or to give me a little bit of what they have, I guess. It's, hey, you know, I do this work and I'll do it for you and let's make this happen. So, like, as a parent, I know how important that is, you know. And I wish, I wish all I had to do was sit here and talk about books and I could get paid for that. That'd be the best thing. Like, I don't know. There's got to be a way to turn that into something I can monetize. But we're still working at it.
Well, if anybody's going to figure it out, it'll be you.
Now, you write fantasy books. I'm going to find this interesting because, you know, the books of yours that I do actually have in my possession, the one of them has a katana-wielding guy in a suit on the front cover, and the other one has what looks like a young man in full-on superhero garb. And so when I think fantasy or science fiction, neither one of those is necessarily what I'm thinking of, the exception being that perhaps one of my favorite science fiction characters was a katana-wielding guy named Hero Protagonist. So what's that about?
So there's a couple of different reasons. I'll go through them real quick with as we talk about each one. But basically, Jisadai, which is the katana-wielding man in a suit, the story behind that one is a bit more sci-fi than it is fantasy, but it's set in a fantastical future of my own devising. And I call it cyberpunk-ish because it has some light themes in that direction, such as cybernetics, nanotechnology, you know, some future tech, and some steps in the wrong direction because of future tech.
The killers obviously are, you know, solos, as you'd think of them in the cyberpunk world.
Mm-hmm. And the idea behind the story initially was I wanted to, because I love Akira Kurosawa films, so I wanted to kind of see if I could come up with a way to encapsulate Kurosawa's samurai stylings into a future sci-fi setting. And in order to do that, I had to do a lot of research. And what came of that was that character on the front cover there, who is called Gabriel, a bit antithetical to samurai stuff, but there's a reason for it. And I wanted to tell dramatic stories through combat. And so the central premise, as you'll read as you go through the story, is that each battle sequence that Gabriel finds himself in has a narrative underneath it. There's a reason for it. It's not wanton destruction. It becomes centered around purpose, the true sense of a samurai, honor and duty take the forefront, as opposed to just being an assassin, which is kill who you're told to kill. He, a brief background, he is the last of a series of cyber-enhanced assassins that were raised and created by a mega corporation that they engage in a low war system because the overarching government declared lethal weapons, firearms, you know, that sort of thing, to be illegal. So in order to continue to one-up each other, the corporations went back to the feudal style low war and started training assassins and sword wielders, and did so to create a whole subculture of murder that went under the radar. These characters, which are called the Holy Eight, they're raised by a man who trains them in individual styles of combat. They're enhanced by the sciences that this mega corporation have been trying to perfect for decades. And there's a whole overarching purpose that would be a huge spoiler to the story, so I'm not going to go there. But Gabriel himself is the last one. And in doing so, the man who trained and raised him, after working with all these other versions, said the best way to control this person is cut them off from society. So Gabriel spends all of his life as a killer for this mega corporation, sent out to kill and then to return and to associate with no one. So he lives this extremely monkish life of eat, sleep, train, kill, up until...
So this wasn't at all inspired by the pandemic?
No, not necessarily, but it did sort of parallel that. It wasn't intentional.
Write what you know?
Maybe a little bit of inspiration, but it was totally unintentional inspiration. And then as the book begins, you know, his whole life changes. And when you read it, you'll understand why. As far as the superhero, that whole premise, Legacy of Heroes, was written as a goodnight kiss to subverted superheroism. The idea that every superhero is a flawed human that is either irredeemable or just can't get over it or whatever, and every villain has a tragic backstory and all that nonsense. I designed those characters, and specifically the one on the cover, to be unique and interesting, but also cleave to old golden age tropes. So that young man on the cover wants to be a golden age superhero. He wants to be like the one that saved him. And that's part of his backstory. He wants to carry on the legacy of this man that saved his life, who also happened to die tragically because of it. And when he gains his own superpowers, he immediately wants to go out and do good for the world, not for any other purpose than to be a good person doing good in the world. And that inspires other people to become better versions of themselves too, like a big ripple effect.
Now, that's something I dwell on a lot. Now, don't get me wrong, because I come from horror, I do like I enjoy the tragic stories. Oh, the villain, did he mean to be bad, or did just the world make him bad? I like those stories. That being said, the fact that that became the overarching theme of comics and, you know, comics and film for the length of time that it did, I don't want to say it's done irreparable damage, but it's taken away from what comics kind of have always, to me, represented. And it's why my favorite villain in a movie ever is the villain from the movie Gamer. The Gamer is not a great movie. That being said, Michael C. Hall makes the perfect villain for me, because there's no tragic backstory. There's no undercutting. He just represents bad. He represents evil. He represents world domination. Like, it's there was no, oh, hey, no plot to rob a bank or steal some money. It was literally just, I want to control everybody on the planet, and I'm going to make that happen. And to me, it represented what classic comic book villains were. They were an archetype for bad, for evil, for wrongdoing. And it's why DC, to me, screws up Superman so bad today, because they're trying to have Superman in a world where Superman can't just represent the ultimate good. Superman isn't supposed to be a reality. Superman is supposed to be the ideal. He's supposed to be what we all aspire to be. Or, you know, in my case, growing up, I wanted to be the Kingpin. The idea being, they're archetypes. They're the things that you aspire to but can't ever reach. You know, it's, you know, in Christian mythology, you have the saints. You have all kinds of things. You know, there's these archetypes and that. But in, like, the modern world, this was our way of telling those old stories again in a way that made sense to us. What are your thoughts on, like, how the world has approached that over the past, you know, say 40 years?
Well, the whole reason I wrote the book in the first place is because I saw it. And it's, in my opinion, wrong. It takes the true purpose of comic book characters and comic book superheroes away, like, removes it completely. Is the whole premise of what I wanted to do with the story, particularly with the character of Paragon, was that he is a modern young man. He's like 18, 19 years old, and he has this thing that happened to him, the specific trauma in his life, that he was saved by a man revered as the pinnacle of a person, both as a superhero and just as a human, lauded as the great icon. Like, he's referenced the greatest hero in the world in the story. And because of that, this young man walks into the situation of becoming a superhero, thinking that he can eventually achieve that same goal of becoming that type of person. To the point where he's even wearing the guy's colors and general costume concept. And he even takes the dude's name. And it's all wound up in this, but through the course of the story, he realizes that it's not as easy as he thought it was. And he goes through this incredible crucible of events that he's embroiled himself in by trying to go out there and do good in this other hero's name. And he realizes that there's a lot more work to it. And that's the whole point of the story itself, is that you have to work hard and sacrifice and go through things that you don't necessarily want to go through in order to achieve your goals, whether they be becoming a superhero or if they're just perfecting your craft or, you know, making the money you want to make, whatever it is that you have to do. It's not as easy as you think. And there's a certain amount of perseverance involved. And that was the thing that I pulled from the old Superman stuff. He always felt like an outsider and was always trying to help people. And even when he was doing everything, quote unquote, right in the Superman comics, he was still seeing what the people thought of him as Clark Kent, the reporter, and often struggled with that. So he could see it from the Superman perspective, but also from the human perspective.
When you're trying to take the characters and when you're trying to make them feel like they're, I don't know, normal, real-world people, it's impossible to get past the fact that if nothing else, and you're in that world, how are you going to function without being self-conscious of the fact that you're running around in spandex and wearing your underwear on the outside? These aren't normal people. They can't be normal people. You'd never get past that phase. Hey, I look like an idiot when I'm out in public. It's a special class. It's a special thing that you have that can't be in real world, because it has to get past just simple stuff like that.
Yeah. I covered that with the creating of costumes in the book. You know, the Paragon character, Dasani, was gung-ho about the costume thing. And one of the other characters, James, who his power is very bizarre and unique, and people seem to like it really, like, a lot. He questioned the need for a costume to begin with. Like, why do I need to look like this in order to do anything? Like, this is kind of stupid. And the third character, Amy, her concern was something that I've always wondered about in comic books when it came to superhero costumes, which is the hypersexualization of women in superhero costumes. She didn't want to show any skin. She didn't want a tight bodysuit. She was concerned, self-conscious about how she would be perceived when they were trying to design it, and ultimately chose to wear a whole coat over top. And that was something that I thought was necessary realism in a modern context, but still trying to answer the question of, you know, capes and cowls.
Well, it's certainly an interesting conversation. I don't feel like you've ever necessarily needed sex to sell characters, but, I mean, be honest, they've been geared towards a certain demographic for a long time, so it's kind of going to necessarily become a shortcut. But, I mean, when I think of, like, you know, classic Rogue, you know, of the X-Men, like, she's got the jacket on. It's not like she's not covered. You don't actually see skin. You've got the form-fitting, you know, body outfit. But a lot of that, you know, as has been talked about, stems from the fact that we're talking about, you know, what essentially are these fictionalized deities. These are our gods. They're, you know, the characters of Athens remade, you know. So you kind of, the fact that they're perfect humans, perfect specimens, is how you feed. Like, if you saw, like, that's why no one believes the, you know, the fat cupcake eating girl from the New Warriors or whatever it was as a superhero, because that's showing an imperfection in your humanity. You're not living up to the standard of everything being perfect. You know, that's why the Blob was a bad guy in the X-Men, because he represented things being out of whack. You know, and if we're focusing on the fact that, you know, superheroes were trying to make these perfect, you know, beings living on Atlantis, you know, Atlantis living on, you know, Mount whatever the hell it is, I don't remember offhand, but, you know, then you're screwing it up by not allowing them to be that.
I mean, in if you really actually deep dive into the mythologies, there were outliers. Hephaestus was written to be quite ugly and deformed and kind of a mess, but he was also extremely talented at what he did, and it was sort of a give and take. But the character of Hephaestus was written for tragedy. That was the purpose, and as far as those myths were concerned. So certain tropes fit in context. Part of the problem with modern situations is that people are trying to ham-fistedly shove, you know, a square peg in, like, through the tiniest of round holes and just smashing through the box to do so. And that makes a complete mess. It just won't work, no matter how hard they try.
Well, like I said, there's a reason archetypes work. It's because structurally your brain understands them, and, like, we could get into the language and linguistic reasons for all of that, but I mean, that's
a much longer conversation.
Yeah, like, we've evolved with stories for thousands of years, and there's a reason certain things work. Like, I mean, it's one of the reasons I tell authors they need to focus so much on characters, because the bottom line is you're telling a story. There's like one, I've heard you can literally boil it down to one story. I think four is sufficient. There's only four stories you can tell, period. Everything is an embellishment on those four core stories. And some people will reduce it just to the one if you follow, like, reduce the story enough. But the thing that is the human element. How do you connect with all of these stories? What is the avatar through which you're going to live those stories? And it's why understanding characterization in a story is so important, because you don't immediately focus. It's like, why do we remember Sherlock Holmes? Why do they continue to reboot Sherlock as a character in a million different ways? Because Sherlock Holmes is an archetype that we can all brand ourselves to. He is my favorite misunderstood genius character. That's why we like Sherlock Holmes. We like him being a prick, like him being autistic and kind of knowing he's better than everybody else, but living the life of actually being better than everyone else, you know?
And the loneliness of it that drove his closeness with Watson.
Yeah. Like, I know I'm not Holmes, but there's, he represents like the most best version of what I'd like to be in life, you know? For me, like, I always ask people, well, who's your favorite X-Man? And for me, it's always either Hank McCoy or I can't remember the guy's name. I never remember it, but Nightcrawler. Like, Beast and Nightcrawler are my two favorite X-Men for a variety of reasons.
Kurt Wagner.
Yeah, there we go. That's right. Both of them are great characters. And why do they resonate with me? I mean, that could be its own show right there. Well, why do I resonate with these two characters? The fact of the matter is that there's nobody, if I ask that question, who's your favorite X-Men, that's not going to have an answer. All I can tell you for sure is that it won't be Cyclops.
He's not my top number one, but I actually like Cyclops quite a bit. Or liked until, the recent change.
You don't know how many things you just told me about yourself there, Daniel.
Yeah, I'm sure. My favorite X-Man is Colossus.
He'd be high on my list. I love Colossus. And what do I love about Colossus is that Colossus, even in what is already, because they were already starting to subvert tropes with the X-Men, Colossus kind of represents that classic, old school, like one dimensional good guy. He's the big strong man that, you know, goes out to do good. He's, you know, the voice of reason. He's the guy who sounds like Superman in the X-Men world. And so I certainly respect him for that.
Yeah, I was fascinated by him because the concept to me was less offensive and more defensive. Even though he was super strong, the idea was that he was the devoted defender type. You know, he armored up and then he was in the way of things that were trying to hurt everybody else. And that was sort of his personality. And even in his backstory, that was where it all sort of all kind of culminated. The tragic accident where his powers erupted in the first place. And I was fascinated by that, and then I was more fascinated when they brought in the concept of his sister and trying to protect her. His whole motivation was, I just want to save people.
Well, I guess I'm curious, and you think they did a good job with him in like the most recent Deadpool movie? Okay, I'm curious. What are the issues you have with it? Because what you mentioned there, I mean, that's the way they play his character. He's the defender. He's not the guy they put in the offense. He's the guy that's there specifically to absorb the blows from Juggernaut. Like, he's there so Juggernaut doesn't just destroy everybody.
Right. And while the representation of the character was accurate, the context of his position in the narrative as the quote-unquote straight man to Deadpool's zaniness. Like, they did the odd couple thing with the two of them, and I think that was the whole point of using the character in the first place, was that Deadpool's wackiness was in such stark contrast to Colossus, to Piotr's seriousness about the profession of heroism, that it worked in the story, and I'm fine with that. But for people who may not recognize the character regularly, like most people, you say X-Men, the first thing that comes up is Wolverine. You know, anyone, a fan of X-Men as a comic book throughout the decades will go, okay, yeah, it's a good representation, but, you know, they made him a joke on purpose because it's a jokey movie, sure. But someone who goes to watch Deadpool just because they watched the first Deadpool movie and, you know, is shown the character for the first time of Colossus is going to think this guy's a doofy idiot.
Okay. Well, I guess I can see that. Yeah, allowing him to be the brunt of the joke in that sense. But in that context, you're also making Deadpool. If you're watching a Deadpool movie, you're probably watching it because, once again, that whole character exists to subvert the idea of a superhero in the first place. Like, that's he's part of that new world, part of that world where it was the Watchmen and shit like that. So, well, moving along, you know, let's kind of pivot here because we're actually over time already. It's too much crap to talk about with you, Daniel. What are the things from an author's standpoint that you think that people need to be focusing more on when it comes to marketing their books?
Stop trying to sell people your world. The world is not going to draw people in. Historically, from a marketing standpoint, look at commercials for every movie. Every shot is about the hero, and the in-betweens are the interactions with the supporting cast. It's about connecting with the character. Yeah, it's about connecting with some person in the cast that can draw readers or observers or whatever into the story. And then once they're into the story, then you show them the world that it's all happening in. It reminds me of plays. You know, plays back used to be the premier way of telling a story in, you know, we'll go so far back even to Shakespeare. Plays were done on the stage with very minimal set dressing. And what made people keep coming back to these stories was not the set. It was the characters that were being portrayed and how well the characters were being portrayed and how well written the characters were to be portrayed.
Well, moreover than that, even people that grow up in our age, they don't understand even like how much the microphone has changed things. Because when you think back to, go back to Shakespeare, the dialogue itself had to carry because you were basically screaming at the top of your lungs to get the dialogue out. There was no acting. There was no inflection. There's none of that. Like, that's all shit that we do now because we have microphones that can amplify when you're whispering.
Right. Turn a whisper into a shout.
But, like, that didn't exist back then. You had to be able to get it out in the dialogue, what you were trying to say. And, man, it's like what you think about movies today. Like, look at the acting. Everyone's like, oh, The Rock's a fine actor. No, The Rock's a terrible actor. He gets by on the fact that we have digital video and can record as many takes as we want. Like, they used to record two-hour movies in, like, a week and a half. Because guys could just show up, crush the role. You know, Humphrey Bogart's not going to take 6 months to make a damn movie because he went in there and he acted and he had the character right.
We were just talking about that on Iron Age Nights, the Westerns getting done in 2 weeks.
When they show up, they embody the character, they do it, boom, we move on to the next thing. Like, it's not complicated storytelling. You're just putting someone in that role to fill the archetype. You know, and it's why if you're going to tell a story, like, you need to focus on, like, what is the thing that makes this version of this archetype unique? One of my favorite storylines I have, and I love the author too. That's why I got hooked on him through this work, though. James Lovegrove, who just released a new one in the series, but he had basically Sherlock Holmes in the world of Cthulhu. You know, in an H.P. Lovecraft world, he's fighting cultists and things like that. There's another guy who does that same thing because all that stuff's public domain now. The difference is that, like, the other guy never captured me. Like, I don't read his books when they come out because there's an honesty. Maybe I don't feel in the character. It feels kind of two-dimensional. Whereas the flair that Lovegrove has telling those same stories, it's the same character, same type of setting. Like, if you're relying on just, hey, Sherlock Holmes and Cthulhu, well, it's an open field. There's plenty of guys there. But why is that the one that I read? It's because of the character. It's because of the development. It's because of the emotional impact that that character feels. Like, that character, the story exists in such a way as that, like, I want to know what this guy, this person that I feel like is gonna deal with it. And I could never do that in the other guy's novels. Obviously, the fact that I call him the other guy and never bothered to commit his name to memory says a lot.
Yep, that's for sure. And that is something that we as Iron Agers have ahead of us that's kind of a mountain to climb is creating something that is three-dimensional enough to be engaging to as many readers as possible in order to build that fan base that we're looking for without pigeonholing ourselves too much in the trope. A lot of that happens, especially with pulp-style writing. There's Mark Twain always comes to mind when anybody talks about this stuff, because he had a memorable quote that I'm going to bastardize and trying to interpret it. But basically the gist of it is that there's no such thing as a new story. And what we do as creators is put the concept into a kaleidoscope and twist it around just enough that it's a little bit different. And then we try to share it with the world. And that's what you want to do. Your take on this thing that everybody loves is fine as long as it's not exactly like the same thing that's already out there.
Once again, why branding is so important as an author. Because, yes, if we know, we go into this knowing that the stories are being retold over and over again, like, that's how it works. We get it. We all sign on and we're okay with that. But you need to bring part of yourself. You need to bring something to the table that is going to make it uniquely you and feel uniquely you. And for me, you know, like, that's characterization. Like, that's, you know, why has Stephen King lasted as long as Stephen King has? Because Stephen King, for all of his faults, he does write compelling characters that you dive into and you feel them. I don't know if anybody's read the Mr. Mercedes or the books that follow that in that series, you know, talking about like a mainstream author. The reason you read those books has jack shit to do with the story. Like, it's, yeah, all of his stories, I can go and watch people being killed and weird sci-fi stuff happen. The things that made those so successful and so interesting is that, like, that the main character, the cop, you connect with him. Like, you're like, ah, you know, it's an old guy. He's kind of past his prime, been tossed into this situation where he's not ready for it, because who's hell's ever ready for this, and somehow manages to persevere. But that's the human condition right there. That's the thing that really makes it work, is that you feel like, oh God, how many things have I ever done in my life that I wasn't prepared for, but like, I'm here now and I got to do them. And you know that feeling, you understand that, you can connect with that character there. And, you know, one of the things, that's why I'm starting my new series, and you're going to be one of the top thing, episode number 3, I'm focusing on your GC Day character, that the characters are what we need to be focusing on in marketing. It's because that's what it's all about. If why did Tolkien tell the story? Oh yeah, he has a cool book of Middle Earth. If it was all about Middle Earth, the only thing anyone would ever read would be the Silmarillion. Because, oh, you get all the Middle Earth that you want in the Silmarillion, but that's never been what it's about. It's those characters. It's everything that's in that. That's what's important. What can we leave people on? Is there anything you wanted to get out in this episode that we didn't manage to get to? Apparently, we're going to have just a running thing of Daniel coming on the show because there's just too much shit to talk about with you.
I have that effect on people, apparently. I can't really think of anything. I mean, it was technically supposed to be about the stories, so I'll give my...
We did talk about the stories, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah, we did. We just got lost in the weeds a little bit.
Well, let's put it this way. The conversations that were sparked through those stories should tell you all that you need to know about the readability of those stories. The fact that there's actual conversation to be had is why you read those stories in the first place. That's certainly the way I read stories.
That's where I approach writing, is I have a question and I'm going to answer that question through these characters. So that I'm going to put these people up against this conundrum and see what happens. Sometimes it goes in a completely different direction than where I intended it to go, but I've learned something by the end of that process that I didn't know before, and that's fascinating to me as a creator, is learning more about the world. And one of the things, I guess, that I'll leave the conversation with about my books is that I don't make tropes. I make people. And I feel a little bad about doing so sometimes because of all the crazy stuff that they have to go through. But when I design an MC or a supporting cast character, like actively design, not the ones that just pop up suddenly, like Athena. When I design them as close to a complicated human being as I possibly can. It's not just this guy's a superhero and he wants to help people. You know, he has a family and he's has experiences and he has personal flaws of character that go well beyond what's necessary for the story and may not even come up. If I don't write another book, you'll never know about them. But I put them in there when I design the person, and it influences every single aspect of their actions. That's I go a little too hardcore into it, I think, maybe. It's like my version of Tolkien-style exposition is going way too deep into a character, but it works for me, and it helps me create someone that I can answer the question with.
Well, and that will give me one last question before we get you out of here. Do you feel like that undercuts the idea of archetypes a little bit? That you know, you go and you do so much work on the characters themselves that you're almost undermining your own goal of not making them overly complicated and dark with tragic backstories.
It's not necessarily a dark and tragic backstory. I don't think everyone is inherently dark and tragic. I think that the world is full of a wide variety of people, and I've met so many of them at this point in my long life of 45 years that you could walk down the street, and if you spent 10 minutes in discussion with every single person you meet as you're walking down that one block, you'll find a lot more than just dark and tragic. You know, it's all in how you see it.
So how about this? Maybe the issue isn't in like the characterization and archetype so much as it is they're forgetting about this one thing that comic books had in the early days that they just don't anymore, and that's hope. And you know, maybe that's is the lack of hope in comics, perhaps. Is that what causes the lack of hope in the real world, or is that a product of there being no hope in the real world? That we've just so got rid of hope as a people that we can't envision a world with that anymore.
Well, that's a chicken and the egg conundrum right there. I mean, it seems entirely possible. We could go on for like an hour just talking about that specifically, but I think everything was created by us as far as comics is concerned, created by people. And the original creators did so with hope in mind. The new creators do so without hope in mind. So if the creator has no hope, how are they going to incorporate that into their story? It's coming from them. It's like we were talking about the author. You learn about the author because they're the one that's writing the story and it's coming from their perspective.
For everybody out there, plenty of things for you to think about in today's episode. Where can we send people there in Daniel?
You can find me on X, Twitter, Twix, if you follow Royce, at Mr. DP Riley. My DMs are open if you ever have any questions about your own writing journey. That's part of what I do in my professional career. And on Amazon.com, you can find me under Daniel P. Riley in the author search where most of my books are located. They're also wherever books are sold, bookstores and whatnot. I went pretty wide with my spread, and I shall continue to do so until I can no longer write.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on today. And thank you, folks, all for listening.
Thank you for having me again.